Another study that came out much more recently, about 10 years ago, 2002, by a man named Jim Kuypers, who is a professor of this emerging field called media ecology at Virginia Tech University. He surveyed 116 newspapers, and among the findings, he said that media operate within a narrow range of liberal beliefs. In other words, liberals think of themselves as being open-minded and tolerant, don't they? But what we find, what Jim Kuypers found, is that they have very little tolerance, in fact, in some cases, very little even understanding or knowledge of views that are outside of a very narrow range of liberal beliefs that they personally hold. And this study also found something that was really interesting, and that is that most journalists tend to omit reasonable conservative voices in their stories in favor of unreasonable conservative voices in their stories. I'll give you a quick example. There is a fellow that you might have heard of. His name is Fred Phelps. He's the pastor of Westboro Baptist Church. He's the guy that goes around to the funerals of military personnel and pickets the funerals with signs that say things like, "God hates fags." Have you know who this guy is? Well, now, I don't know I'm just going to maybe go out on a limb here, but I don't know very many people that thinks that Fred Phelps represents mainstream evangelical Christianity. That his views, while certainly most of us would believe, would say, I would think, that homosexuality is in fact wrong, it is not God's will, it is an evil in the world, I don't think very many of us would go to the extreme that Fred Phelps has gone to by picketing the funerals of servicemen and saying that this, you know, serviceman deserved to die because he was fighting for America. And America is not worth fighting for because we allow homosexuality in this country. Now, there's a kind of a perverse logic to that, but it is not biblical logic necessarily. And so my point, though, is that when I said how many of you have heard of him, many of you nodded yes. Why have you heard of him? Why would a guy whose ideas are well outside the mainstream of Christianity, or at least of evangelical Christianity on this issue, get quoted repeatedly in the mainstream media? I think the answer is exactly what Jim Kuypers is saying in this study, is that there is either intentionally, consciously, or not, there is a desire to make reasonable conservative views either completely unknown or transparent to the American people. They want to highlight the unreasonable conservative views. On the other hand, you will often find in the media the highlighting of the most reasonable liberals, the ones that really look good on television, right? And then the more radical liberal views are often not portrayed. It's one of the reasons why it was really kind of fun to have the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte this past week, because you got to see the leftists in all their glory in Charlotte. I mean, it was really a pitiful thing, but to be able to, I mean, the media couldn't avoid some of the just wacky stuff that leftists and liberals believe. So the point here of Jim Kuypers' study is that radical conservative voices get highlighted, radical liberal voices get omitted. And over time, that has a cumulative effect on the way we think about liberal and conservative views in the media. In fact, I want to give you a quick example. It's not just on the editorial pages that we see this. Even Dear Abby is biased. Now, y'all know who Dear Abby is, right? In fact, I was reading the Billings paper. It's in the Billings paper, right? And what's interesting about Dear Abby is most of the time, including in your paper, where do you find Dear Abby? Where is it in the newspaper? Well, okay, next to the obituaries, but also, well, sometimes in the sports page, but in your paper in particular, it's where? Comics. Yeah, it's on the comics page, right? Who reads comics? Kids read comics, right? That's right. Yeah. Well, I read comics, too. No. Okay. But Dear Abby, yeah, that's right. Dear Abby is in 1,400 newspapers. It's one of the most syndicated columns in America.
110 million readers daily, and 20 million of them are under the age of 18. But the Media Research Center did a study of Dear Abby columns in 2007 and found that 53% of the columns rejected traditional morality. Only one column suggested that marriage should precede sex. 36 columns addressed infidelity, but many of them addressed it favorably, saying that, you know, maybe a little infidelity will spice up your marriage, or, you know, it won't hurt it that much, you know, and or if you're unhappy, you deserve, as Joel Osteen would say, your best life now. You deserve to be happy, right? So go ahead, have a fling. Homosexuality was actively condoned. In fact, PFLAG, the Parents and Family of Lesbians and Gays, is what PFLAG stands for. It's a pro-homosexual group. Says that Abby changed the course of the organization's history several years ago in a positive way by talking about the organization positively and putting the organization's website address in the column, which was, as we said a few moments ago, was seen in 1,400 newspapers around the country. I mean, that's advertising you can't buy, right? Whenever you have a trusted source talking about how great you are and giving contact information right in her column. And so she got this award. In fact, I want to share with you just one quick letter. Walker Percy is one of my favorite writers. He's written a number of, he's now since passed away, conservative Roman Catholic writer. His first book was called The Moviegoer. It won the National Book Award in 1962, which was 50 years ago this year. And so I wrote an appreciation of that novel for our books issue in World Magazine about 2 months ago. But he wrote another book called Lost in the Cosmos, which was a book that looked at some of the ridiculousness going on in our culture at that time. And the book is now more than 25 years old. But he had a famous Dear Abby letter, which I have since fact-checked and discovered that it was indeed a real Dear Abby letter. Wasn't making this up. And I'll do this from memory, but I've read it enough times and it's short enough that I'm pretty close. The letter goes something like this. Dear Abby, I am a 23-year-old liberated woman who is on the birth control pill. I live with my boyfriend, but the birth control pill is expensive. And I think my boyfriend should pay half the cost. However, I don't know him well enough to talk about money. What should I do? Now, Abby's advice was, well, maybe y'all should sit down and have a talk, which is not bad advice. Better advice would be, stop living with your boyfriend, right? But that didn't come up. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you get. I mean, this is just sort of how pervasive the anti-Christian bias is in our media today. It's on the editorial pages. It's in the news content, in what they choose to cover or not cover. And it's also even in our entertainment features as well, like Dear Abby. So it is just thoroughly pervasive. So yes, there is a liberal anti-Christian bias in the content and intent of our media. But what I want to talk a little bit about today, and to maybe even spend a little bit more time on, because I think most of you kind of get that about there being a liberal bias in the content, is what is the effect of the medium itself? Is there an anti-Christian effect in the nature of modern technologically driven media? Modern media has an anti-Christian effect, I'm going to suggest, even if the producers have a Christian intent. And the reason for that is some of the reasons that we've been talking about already and that we saw a bit in that movie Captivated. And that is that you can't teach people to think Christianly if they have lost the ability to think all together, right? So if modern media are eroding our ability to think, we can't learn to think Christianly. It'll be impossible for us to have a Christian worldview. Even if we're consuming content that is quote-unquote Christian in nature, if our ability to think deeply about that content has been eroded to the point where that we're no longer able to do so, then we are missing the gospel. We are missing key aspects of what it means to have a Christian worldview. So, here's the question. Have modern media, technology, and culture eroded our ability to think? Well, a lot of really smart people say the answer to that question is yes. Especially to think deeply about complex issues and ideas, which are the very basis of a Christian worldview, right? I mean, Jesus constantly said, go deeper, go deeper. That was really what he said at all times, go deeper. And he didn't use exactly those words, but sometimes he used something very close to those words. So again, people who know most about media say the answer is yes. One of those is Neil Postman. We talked about Neil Postman a little bit yesterday, but I'd like to dig down a little bit more deeply into Neil Postman today. What Neil Postman said is that media are not culturally or morally neutral. All media have limited abilities. We talked about smoke signals last night, that you can communicate your presence with smoke signals, but you can't discuss philosophy with smoke signals. And he also said that all media have both positive and negative consequences. What, in other words, is the net effect of media? That's what Neil Postman was the most interested in. Poetry, for example, tends to thrive or dominate in an oral culture. Fiction, law, and philosophy tend to thrive in a written culture. Entertainment tends to thrive or dominate in a video culture. Because, again, well, as we talked about yesterday, that the purpose of video is to amuse us, right? Whatever else modern media do, it must first entertain or amuse us to get our attention. And then it gives us whatever content it has after that. And we, again, identified yesterday that what is the word amuse? What is it the opposite of? Yeah, amuse is the opposite of muse, which means to think or to think deeply about something. And now, we also remember, mentioned from last night, that the positive effects show up first with technology. The negative consequences tend to show up later. You remember, I used the example of the happy hour, right? The sign on the door doesn't say, I want to take all your money and make you stupid hour. The sign on the door says, happy hour. It's the take all your money and make you stupid that comes later, right? So the positive impacts of any new technology tends to show up first. The negative impact tends to show up later. Now, this to me came into sort of stark focus whenever I heard about the Facebook burglar, and I couldn't resist incorporating the Facebook burglar into my presentation. The story of the Facebook burglar is actually pretty simple. A woman has her house robbed, right? And she's upset by that. But she thinks to herself, wait a minute, I've got video cameras, I've got security cameras in my house. I'll take the security camera video, I'll post it on the internet, on my Facebook profile. People will maybe be able to help me identify who the burglar was. Well, guess what? That's exactly what happens. So people see the video, somebody knows who that person is, they go arrest the guy. So they arrest him, he's down at the police station, and everybody at this point is thinking, wow, this is a happy ending. This is the story of technology being used for some positive purpose to arrest a burglar. But then they question the burglar. And the burglar says, well, I knew this woman was going to be away for the evening because she had posted on her Facebook profile that she was going to be out. So that's how I knew to go rob her house. So again, the technology makes it look like, you know, a positive impact has shown up. But when you know the whole story, the rest of the story, you see that technology has both positive and negative impacts on our lives. And as Christians, we've got to be discerning about understanding both the positives and the negatives before we adopt a new technology into our lives, into our families, into our communities, and into our churches. Because again, let me repeat, the positive impacts tend to show up first, right? The negative impacts show up later. So for example, in church, and I don't want to... we can do this more in the Q&A. In church, you know, the church was quick to adopt all kinds of technologies long before we really realized what those technologies were all about. I remember, for example, whenever we used to sing hymns out of a hymn book. And now we sing hymns from an overhead projector, right? From a big screen in front of us. It's where we'll follow, it's, you know, sing along with Mitch Miller, right? Follow the bouncing ball in church. Now, you know, that's not a terrible thing. I mean, it gets, but think about the difference between a hymn book and a PowerPoint presentation, right? That the hymn book has had some great theologians and knowledgeable music people look at all of the possible hymns that were available to us and make a decision that these hymns, after careful consideration, most clearly reflect the theology and doctrine that we want to both affirm ourselves and teach our children. But what happens whenever you can change hymns that you sing or change songs that you sing just by simply creating a new PowerPoint slide? What do you tend to do? You tend to adopt those songs that are the newest, right? And that have been most popular in the top 40 radio stations within the last 6 months or a year. Now, that's not to say that I don't think great music is being written today. I think probably a lot of great music is being written today. I just think we won't know for another 50 years which of it is great and which of it is not so great. Because great music, among other things, stands the test of time, right? And it ministers to people, it speaks to people, it talks to people, not just one person today, but many people over a long period of time. It's the highest and the best that we should be holding up. You know, a lot of bad stuff was written in the 1800s. We just don't sing it today. It's been lost to history. A lot of bad stuff is being written today, but, you know, we sing it. All right, but we're going to come a little bit more and talk about that some more in a minute. So does God have a preferred medium? Neil Postman said the answer to that question is yes. And he said it's a book. It's the written word. God gave us a book. The God of the Jews, Postman said, was to exist in the Word and through the Word. An unprecedented conception requiring the highest order of abstract thinking. In other words, what Neil Postman said is this, that the Word, the written Word, is unique because it requires engagement, as opposed to video media that do not require active engagement. So that's what Postman said. And he says that that's why God gave us a book. Now, Marshall McLuhan takes this idea in a somewhat different direction. Marshall McLuhan was a Canadian, was a Catholic, committed Catholic. He was a conservative. He wrote a book. It's one of his most famous books was called Understanding Media. And his most famous expression was, the medium is the message. Many of you may have heard that expression before. But a lot of folks don't know that he came up with this metaphor that explained the medium as the message. And this metaphor is sometimes called McLuhan's light bulb. And let me try to quickly explain to you McLuhan's light bulb. Let's imagine for a moment that we're all in this room together and the lights go completely out. It becomes suddenly pitch black in this room. Okay? Now, let's imagine that you walk into this room without knowing what is in this room. What's your behavior going to be? Cautious. Right? It's black. You can kind of hear noises. You might even hear a couple of people, you know, talking in this room. So that might cause you to be a little jittery. Who's in the room? Friend or foe? Am I about to trip and fall and bust my lip open? Or is there, you know, wide open field here? I don't know what's in this room, so I'm going to be cautious. I'm going to be guarded. It's going to affect my behavior, right? I might walk around like this as I go through this room. All right. Now, put that image in your mind. Now, another image. You walk into this room, perfectly pitch black, but then somebody turns the lights on and you can see what's in this room. What's your behavior going to be in that case? It's going to change at a minimum, right? You might look around and say, friend or foe? Well, I'm not sure. I see a few friends and a few foes in this room, right? But whatever your behavior does, it will certainly be different. You'll be able to see where you can walk, you can move around, you might go get you a cup of coffee or a drink of water, whatever it is. Your behavior changes. Now, let me ask you the important question. Did anything change relative to the contents of the room? Contents of the room were exactly the same. What changed? What changed was the medium by which you experienced this room, right? That when it was pitch black, you experienced the room with senses other than sight. With feeling, with sound, maybe with smell, whatever it might be. But whenever the lights came on, you were able to experience the room with a different medium. It changed your behavior, it changed your attitudes, it changed your assumptions. Now, what Marshall McLuhan says is that not only do all media have different capabilities, but all media have a different ability in particular to transmit not only the message, but the bearer of the message. And Marshall McLuhan uses the telegraph. He said that for the first time in history, the telegraph allowed the message to be transmitted without the messenger. But because we have 6,000 years of history hardwired into us, we tend to impute characteristics to the messenger based on receiving the message alone. So that's why Marshall McLuhan would say with the telegraph for the first time, the message could be sent without the messenger. And so what we start doing in our minds is to construct who that messenger or what that messenger is. In other words, we start constructing reality based on what is in that message. And yet we all know, based on what we've said so far, that whatever is in that message is necessarily an incomplete picture of the messenger, of the reality itself. So you see what I'm saying? So he's saying that there's a fundamental dislocation whenever with electronic media between the message and reality. And he goes on to say that with TV, we've created the illusion that the messenger has been sent. Not the reality, but the illusion. Television and movies force what he calls suspended judgment, as opposed to what happens whenever you engage the printed word, which is what Coleridge called the willing suspension of disbelief. We have instead an unwilling suspension of disbelief. Now, I'm going to give you a really quick example of that right now. I want everybody to look up here at me. Are you looking? I want you to hold your hand out. Everybody hold your hand out in front of you like I'm doing it right here. Everybody hold your hand out. Okay, now I want everybody in this room to put their hand on their chin. Please put your hand on your chin. Okay, now this is your chin. Okay, this is your cheek. This is your chin. Now some of you are doing this because you kind of knew. He said, well, wait a minute. He said chin, but he's got to say, wait a minute. So I'll just cover my bases here, right? Okay. So again, this is an example of how the visual medium, right? I know, I'm guessing at least, everybody in this new room knew the difference between right and wrong when it comes to the difference between cheek and chin, right? In other words, it wasn't a question of knowledge that caused you to do the wrong thing. But the visual stimulus that I was giving you overrode everything that you knew about yourself and your anatomy and what I was saying to you. Now, isn't that interesting? We're going to do another exercise before the end of the hour. But again, it's just an example of how television and video, the visual stimulus, can override what we know to be true and what we, in the way that we think we want to behave and ought to behave. So again, does God have a preferred medium? We keep coming back to this question. David Wells, who wrote a book called No Place for Truth, it's a book that I was talking with somebody about during the break, said this: biblical faith is about truth. God has described himself in his works to us in the language of the Bible, and it is presumptuous for us to say that we've found a better way to hear him, a better way to find reality. The Bible says it this way: has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom does not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached. Some translations say through the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe. 1 Corinthians 1:20. Now, it is ironic in a way that God would choose a book and the foolishness of preaching as the primary media by which to communicate his gospel. But apparently, according to Scripture, according to a lot of really smart people, that's what he chose in his sovereignty to do. So, interesting question. Does God have a preferred medium? It seems to me that the answer to that question is yes. So what I'd like to do is to do another little quick exercise that I think will help demonstrate this. I've got few minutes left here. So it's called the Stroop Effect. And if has anyone ever seen this before or heard this before, the Stroop Effect? Okay, it's pretty easy. You're going to have to pay attention to the screen. Can you guys over here see the screen pretty well? Okay, all right, good. You're going to need to see the screen for this. But this demonstrates how the nature of a medium can overwhelm the content of the medium. Okay, so we're going to do something, and you're going to need to look at the screen. I want you to tell me what color you see on the screen? Well, maybe I should stop. Y'all know your colors? Anybody here know your colors? Okay. So you've all graduated from kindergarten. Do you know your colors over here? Okay, good. Yeah, good, good, good. Okay. And I know you can read, right? Some of you, most of you can read. I mean, I'm not talking about big words like ontology or philosophy. I'm talking about little words like red and green, right? And yellow and black. Y'all can read those words, right? Okay, let's back up and let's try it again. Oh, this might not be good. Okay, here we go. All right, so we're going to go through these four colors, and I want you to tell me whether we're just read them out loud with me. All right, read the colors. Tell me what the colors are, okay? Red, green, yellow, black. Oh, what happened? Black. Okay, you with me? Okay, let me see if I can make this work. All right, here we go. On your mark, get set, go. Red, green, yellow, black. Red, green, yellow, black. Red, green, yellow, black. Red, green, yellow, black. Red, green. Okay. Now, what happened here? Well, I'll tell you what happened. The big heart? The yellow wasn't yellow, was it? The black wasn't black on this column. Now over here, you got lulled, right? You got lured into it. Some of you didn't, right? It didn't move as fast. I couldn't make this go as fast as I wanted it to go. So, but red is red, green is green, yellow, black, and so on. So what happens is, and plus I'm saying it right over and over again. I'm droning, right? Red, green, yellow, black. You get lured into this pattern. But then by the time you get to this side of this page, you realize that something's not happening right. Some of you were able to kind of sort of step back and figure it out. Most of you just got confused, right? Now this exercise is called the Stroop effect. The phenomenon that it is demonstrating is called word dominance theory, right? And that is that you wanted to read the word rather than tell me what color the word was. That our brains are kind of hardwired to want to read the word. And it's called word dominance theory. But what happens whenever the reading of the word and the color of the word are different, it generates what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. Have y'all ever heard that expression before, cognitive dissonance? In other words, you've got your knowledge coming in from one sense, which is the color, telling you something different from what the word says. So there's dissonance between the data coming in from these two senses, and you've got to somehow resolve that dissonance. That's called cognitive dissonance. So, you know, hey, I thought you knew your colors. So what are the lessons of the Stroop effect? Well, in part, the lessons of the Stroop effect are these: that the speed and the nature of a medium can overwhelm content. Now, so that even if you're pouring positive Christian content into certain kinds of media, what you are teaching is not the content, but lessons of alienation and disengagement, whether you want to do that or not. The fundamental characteristics of these media cause us to behave and act in certain ways, whether we want to behave and act in those ways or not, irrespective of what the medium or what the content of that medium is. Another thing that's interesting, in my opinion, is, and we see this a lot in the modern world, right? We've got a lot of churches in America, don't we? We've got a lot of pastors in America, and yet we also have a lot of people behaving badly in America as well. We've got homosexual marriage, we've got abortion, we've got pornography, we've just got all these ills. And in some ways you have to ask yourself, why is that? And what has happened with modern media is that we have become, knowledge has become dislocated from behavior, right? And that the ability to do the right thing is slowly being dislocated from knowledge of what the right thing is. The will to do the right thing is not the same as the knowledge of doing the right thing. So in this particular case, or in that example of that we did a few moments ago where I asked you to put your hand on your chin, you knew the right answer. Knowledge of the right answer was not the reason that you didn't produce the right answer. So the question is, why couldn't you give us the right answer? Why couldn't you give me the right answer? And part of the answer to that is that you'd been confused. You had just simply been buffaloed and dumbed down. Temporarily in this case. But what I would submit to you is that when this happens over and over and over again, that temporary befuddlement becomes a permanent cultural condition, even in the church. Now, how many of you have ever read C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters? Some of you in this room? You might remember at the very beginning of that letter, of that book, one of the very first letters, in fact, it may even be the first letter in The Screwtape Letters, the young demon in the book is his name is Wormwood, you remember, has in his charge a human being that he's trying to lead astray, right? And he gets advice from Screwtape. And Screwtape always signs his letters, "Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape." You remember that? Well, the young Wormwood is saying, my human client is thinking about God, and I need you to share with me two or three proofs for the non-existence of God so that I can have, you know, this argument with him about the existence of God. And do you remember what Screwtape says to Wormwood? He basically says, "Don't be a fool. Don't argue with the human. They've got the truth on their side. If he starts thinking deeply about these matters, we're dead. We've lost. So don't cause him to think. Distract him. Use those tools that are at our disposal. Make his stomach growl so that he remembers that it's time for lunch about the time that he wants to start thinking deeply about these matters. You know, bring somebody into his life that'll, you know, take him to a movie or whatever it might be." So again, the distraction, the speed and the nature of these media erode our ability to think deeply about these matters that I believe Scripture wants us to think deeply about. So knowledge of the right or wrong answer has little effect on our ability to produce the right answer, not because we don't know the right answer, but because we're confused, we're befuddled, we're distracted. We have cognitive dissonance going on in our lives. Sometimes it's because of our own behavior. The medium producer, in this case it was me, could get you to produce just about any answer that I wanted you to produce, and I could even get you, in some cases, to believe that you had given the right answer. In other words, until I left the screen up for a while, you were able to actually see, oh, wait a minute, yellow is not yellow, red is not red. It was only then that some of you probably made the connection between what was the right and the wrong answer. So a lot of us go through life consuming modern media, getting fed the wrong answer, not even knowing that it's the wrong answer because we can't slow down enough to think through the process. So, again, the nature of media have a tremendous effect on us. The medium, in other words, really is the message in some fundamental ways. The nature of a medium often communicates more than content. Media have the power to manipulate and confuse. So, let me say, am I saying again that we should be anti-media or anti-technology? The answer to that question is no. I don't think we should be anti-media or anti-technology. But we need to stand for and with the good, the true, and the beautiful, and stand for and with those who are producing the good, the true, and the beautiful. Now, at World Magazine, we use what we call a tool or a technique that we call biblical storytelling. And biblical storytelling is simply trying to tell stories from God's perspective. So one example of that is that in World Magazine, you would rarely find us saying abortion is bad. Though all of us believe abortion is bad, right? That abortion is a great evil. But for purposes of World Magazine, what we tend to do is to tell stories that show and not just tell the consequences. So a story in World Magazine might not say abortion is bad, but it might sound like this. Jane, when she was 15 years old, found herself pregnant. She decided, against the advice of her friends, not to have an abortion and to have this baby. And now fast forward 20 years, here's James' life. Here's how rich James' life is with having had now this 20-year-old child in her life. Or on the other side, it might be that Jane chose to have an abortion and that it led to many years of negative consequences in her life. So what we tend to do at World Magazine is to take seriously the idea that ideas have consequences and that we portray the consequences of the ideas rather than simply say what the ideas are. That's the way we adopt this notion of biblical storytelling. But it's important that the narratives that we tell attach to a meta-narrative. And if you've seen any of John Stonestreet's, so did John talk about this whenever he was here before? I don't remember. A little bit, just a little bit. Basically, what John Stonestreet says is that the Christian worldview understands that life is more than just my story and your story. In other words, what you hear often today is that, well, that may be your story or your truth, but that's not my truth, right? And in that is sometimes called the postmodern worldview, where there is no big picture. There is no overarching purpose to history. The Christian worldview says that there is an overarching purpose to history, that it is that God created the world. He created it good. He created man in his image, but man is fallen, and human history is the story of God's redeeming grace in his world and ultimately the restoration of a new heaven and a new earth. That's the meta-narrative. That's the overarching story of history. Postmoderns reject the meta-narrative, but they still have this longing for story. So what happens is that everybody tells their own story, right? Remember yesterday whenever we were talking, when we were watching a little bit of Captivated, how one of the attractions of Facebook is that everybody gets to write their own biography. It is the most narcissistic medium in the history of mankind. But it has an attraction because we do understand the power and the importance of story, but we have lost our connection to that meta-narrative. So, again, I'm not arguing against story, I'm arguing for story. But I'm also arguing for story in the context of the meta-narrative. It's got to connect to God's bigger story, or it is just an example of the original heresy, that we can be as God, that we can create our own reality, that we can create our own truth. We should use all of the technological tools that God in his good providence has made available to us. But again, let me reiterate something that I've been saying all since last night and all through today, that we should be aware of both the abilities and the limitations of all media. So solving the problem, we've got to have great discernment, greater discernment by the people of God. Well-meaning people are getting sucked in to a technological culture that is eroding our ability to think. Biblically sound leaders need to speak out, but I will have to say in defense of pastors that there is often little to gain and much to lose for pastors to speak out on these matters, for them to criticize fellow pastors and fellow leaders. That's why those of us that sit in the pews need to support those pastors who do so, because they need that encouragement. They need to find their courage. Christian journalists can play a role, we believe, but that's the reason we're in the business that we are in. Because one of the things that we can do is, again, one of the goals and key responsibilities of Christians is to name the animals. One of the things that we think we do at World Magazine is to give you guys the vocabulary and the stories and the data and the facts that you need to help you name these animals in your own community. So we know that our readers are all... readers are leaders. That's an expression that we use all the time at World Magazine. So we know that our readers are leaders in their local communities. And what we're trying to do is to give you a tool to fight these battles in your communities. I'm going to skip past this because we're really running out of time. Again, resources for discerning Christians, my email address. I want to close with one story, though, before I open the floor to questions, Dick. I've got 11 o'clock precisely, 10 or 15 minutes for questions. But let me just tell you a really quick story. Partly because of the time of year it is. We're in early September of 2013, 2012. I want to take you back to early September of 1940. Some of you might actually be old enough to remember September of 1940. We've got George here. Right? You're 88 years old, is that right? Yeah, great. So you can actually remember that. Some of us might just remember from the history books. But I will tell you that what was happening then was the Battle of Britain. The Battle of Britain, you would see, was before Pearl Harbor. America had not entered the war. Hitler had basically conquered Europe by this point, the mainland of Europe, and had decided that free England was what was standing between him and total world domination, or at least European domination. As long as England remained free, Germany was under threat. And Hitler knew that. Tyrants are always afraid of free people, no matter how many there are or how few there are. So what Hitler decided to do was to invade and take over England. But he knew in order to do that, he had to soften their defenses. He couldn't just come across the English Channel with a bunch of men in boats. He was going to have to soften their defenses with an air war. And so he sent his Luftwaffe over the English Channel day in and day out to bomb England. And it was having a terrible effect on England, except for one thing. The Royal Air Force rose up every day in defense. And now the Royal Air Force only had about 2,000 planes. They had maybe 4 or 5,000 pilots, but no, that's not accurate. That's not, I'm saying that just the opposite. They only had about 2,000 pilots. They had 4,000 or 5,000 planes, so the planes would get shot out from under them, and then they would go up in a new plane the next day. But they only had about 2,000 or 2,500 pilots. But every day, these men would get in these planes and go up, and they would fight the Luftwaffe as they came across the English Channel. Got to the point where Hitler was losing so many planes that he realized that he needed to start coming over at night. Now, because otherwise that, you know, that was the only way that he could get in and out. But night bombing was much less accurate than daytime bombing. So after month after month after month, from August 1940 to October of 1940, Hitler sent these planes across, and the Royal Air Force rose to meet them every single day. A lot of times they would get shot down, but because they were over the English Channel or over English territory, they would get picked up and get into another plane and go up. And so what ultimately happened was that Hitler had to abandon his plans of a land invasion of England because of those 2,000 men that got in those airplanes day after day. And you remember what Winston Churchill said about the Battle of Britain? He said, "Never before in the annals of valor have so many owed so much to so few." Do you remember that? It's one of the great sayings of English, of the English-speaking world. And so that story, I'll just be honest with you, is an encouragement to me. I would argue to you that media is the air war in the Christian fight in our country today. And some of you may be saying, but there's so few of us. I mean, think about this. On a Saturday morning in Billings, Montana, 100 of us are gathered in this room. It's not many, right? Not many folks that are taking the energy, making the effort to develop a Christian worldview, to understand what the real impact of media is and how it should be properly used in our world. But when I think about that story of the Battle of Britain, it really gives me some encouragement. When I think that, you know, it doesn't take many, it just takes a few, a remnant with God. So thank you for letting me share some of these ideas with you. I hope you found them helpful. I hope that they allow you to then turn around from this place and go into your families, your churches, your schools, your communities, and have a positive impact for the kingdom there. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take the first question, but it's totally your option.
Okay.
You may want to do something else. Would you talk for a minute about Becky?
Becky, yeah, I left Becky out, didn't I? Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. Well, Becky, just real quickly, it's in the book, by the way, and was it on the slide? Did I just gloss over it on the slide? I don't remember.
No, I just thought of it.
Okay. Well, Becky, we've got a Christian radio station in Charlotte. It's a music-intensive Christian radio station. They play, you know, contemporary Christian music. I'm sure you probably got one here in Billings, right? Is there one in Billings? So the program director, there's actually a pretty good friend of mine. His name is Joe Paolo. And I went to him one day and I said, Joe, you know, how do you decide what you play on your radio program? On your station. And he says, well, we've got in our mind Becky. And I said, really, Becky? Tell me about Becky. He said, well, most radio stations talk in demographics, 18 to 34-year-olds or 18 to 54-year-old women. And what we discovered at some point was that the difference between an 18-year-old woman and a 54-year-old woman is a pretty big difference, right, in terms of their taste and where they are in life and their lifestyle and things that they do. So we said we needed to be much more specific than that. We need to program our radio station for a 34-year-old mother who's got a couple of young kids, who's driving, you know, works a little bit, but mostly stays at home with her kids. That's the profile that they were going for as a listener. And we just thought we would give her a name. And so we started calling her Becky. And we started doing research on who Becky is. Well, Becky may or may not be a Christian. If she may or may not, she probably goes to church some, but she's really concerned about the moral problems in the country. And so, for example, she doesn't want to listen to the rock and roll radio station, even though she might have been raised on rock and roll, because she's got Junior in the back seat and a car seat. And you never know what might come out of the radio if you've got Junior in the back seat, right? That's the reason this particular radio station's slogan was, safe for the entire family. Have any of y'all ever heard that on Christian radio? Safe for the entire family. And when I heard that, Dick, a light bulb went off in my brain. And many of y'all have read the Chronicles of Narnia, right? And you remember how Aslan is described in the Chronicles of Narnia? He's a good lion, but he's not what? He's not safe. He's not safe. And whenever, and listen, I've got children. I get safe, right? One of my responsibilities as a father is to protect my children. I get safe. I understand safe. But when safe becomes our highest value, I believe we have departed the way of truth. We have departed the way of the gospel. So here's the net effect, is that we have Becky programming our Christian radio stations. And Becky may not be a Christian, may not be a churchgoer, but Becky's taste in music is what gets played on contemporary Christian radio. What gets played on contemporary Christian radio gets heard by our church and worship leaders. And then that becomes what we, 6 months later, are singing in our church. So rather than having our songs vetted and carefully scrutinized by the greatest thinkers, by the godliest men and women of our generation, we've got Becky deciding what we sing in church every Sunday.
Did Becky have anything to do with Focused on the Family disappearing on that radio station?
Well, it could be. In fact, I talk about an anecdote in there where Focused on the Family actually did a series on, I believe it was on homosexuality. I'm drawing a blank on it right now. It's in my own book. Read my book. I need to go read my book so I can remember what I wrote. But what happened was a lot of radio stations, because their programming became dominated by this safe for the entire family ethos, whenever Focus on the Family started doing some very powerful but kind of tough segments on homosexuality and other tough topics, this particular radio station ultimately canceled the Focus on the Family daily radio program.
Did Becky have anything to do with the books we buy?
Well, Becky does have a lot to do with both the books and the music that we buy, because what's happened is that, I was talking with some of you at breakfast about sort of the abdication that men have, in our families, in our communities, in our churches, sort of the feminization of our culture. And part of the reason for that is that the Christian church has become, ladies, I love you. I'm married to one. I've got two daughters. I really do love you, ladies. But the church has become so feminized that many guys just can't stand to be there anymore. And so you look at most churches, especially if you go to the bigger mega churches, and just pick a row at random. I invite you to go to a big church, pick a row at random, and just count the people on that row, and then look at how many men versus how many women are there. And you will usually find that most mega churches are at least 55 to 60% women, and in part because the music that we sing, the books that we write, the sermon series, the preaching, everything tends to be oriented towards Becky. Becky is, you know, Becky has become what the evangelical church is all about.
Your questions.
I'll break the ice for you. A couple of things I wanted to respond to in your presentation. When you were saying stand for and with those that are producing the good, the true, and the beautiful, I just became aware of the release dates for Last Ounce of Courage. Maybe some of you are aware of that. Mm-hmm. It's produced or directed by the same guy who did Schindler's List. So I'm assuming it would be of similar quality.
It's not. I've seen it.
Oh, okay.
Anyway. But go see it. Support okay. the guy. The next one might be better.
Well, and I guess what I was hearing was that Stand USA is hoping that we will deliver a message to Hollywood saying we want more of this kind of thing by going out on the premiere weekend, which is next weekend.
Right. Right.
There is also a special showing, I think, on 9/11 in some locations, and then 9/14 is the weekend release. Also with what you said about narrative storytelling, I got a hold of a copy of a DVD on the subject of abortion specifically. It's called Life After Abortion, and it does a really good job of exactly that technique, where it just starts out showing clips of interviews with women and men who have been impacted by abortion, making that choice and what it's done to them. So my question for you is, for those people who are illiterate, we might say, who either can't read well and think well or don't, then what would be your recommendation for communicating truth? Do we go ahead and use that video medium that they can relate to? Or what would you suggest?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure with just that amount of information I know the answer. I can tell you what my mother-in-law does is she teaches people to read. You know, she teaches adults to read, and they use the Bible as their tool for learning how to read. And I guess unless somebody is seriously mentally disabled, I guess I have a lot of trouble understanding why folks, you know, wouldn't have, at least in our culture, the ability to read. Now, if we're talking about, you know, going to a pre-literate culture, then I guess that becomes a different question.
Thank you so much. When you were talking about producers producing the effect that they want to produce with us, and you used the demonstration of the cheek versus the chin, it made me think of Fox News. I'd like you to speak a little bit as a journalist about Fox News, because I see a lot of solidly Christian, quote, conservative people following Fox News like sheeple to the slaying of our nation because of what Fox News suggests for politics and whatever. So I'd like you to elaborate on
that. Yeah, no, that's a good question. And, you know, and it's a big question that I'm not going to be able to answer completely. And I probably, the little bit of answer I give, I'll probably make at least somebody in this room mad. But, you know, I think it's important that we understand that conservative and Christian are not necessarily the same thing. That a Christian, that now in this cult, conservative is always a relative term, right? You know, I mean, liberal versus, I mean, that's always a Christian is never a relative term. You know, a Christian worldview is based on eternal truths and eternal positions. And, you know, I think it's just important to understand what you've got with Fox News. I mean, is it better than, you know, MSNBC? Yeah, I think it's better than MSNBC, you know, in a lot of ways. But it's not Christian. You know, I mean, there are a few Christians on there. In fact, I know, you know, I've been on Fox News, you know, maybe half a dozen times myself over the years. And Lauren Green, their religion editor, I know her well. She's a deeply committed Christian person. But they're, you know, it's a mixed bag over at Fox News in terms of their producers. They are, you know, they're owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's a market niche for them. Now, for some of them, it's not. I mean, I know Britt Hume. I know Lauren Green. You know, I know a few of the others over there. I'm drawing a blank on some of the ones I know right now. Some of them are good guys. And it's not just a market niche for them. I mean, they're passionate about what they do. But at the end of the day, you know, you got to understand that it's a commercial enterprise. They see conservatism as a market niche. And that's who they are. Now, would I recommend Fox News over MSNBC? Absolutely. But again, you know, when I do this presentation to kids, I do it a lot to kids, I always ask usually, how many of you want to be journalists when you grow up? Or filmmakers? Or writers? Or some way engaged in the creative arts? And amazingly, I'll get a lot of hands that will go up. And I'll say, well, great, this is for you. But for those of you that didn't raise your hand, let me tell you, you, if you're not going to be a producer of media, you're going to be a consumer of media. And we all have to be discerning consumers of media, and I would say that applies even to Fox News.
Yeah, and one of the problems is that we've really underlined all we've done in the last 4 hours is we've come to a point where that media has to be entertaining. We demand it, not just the unchristians. We demand it too.
I also have two questions.
Sure.
Rob Bell, in his book Love Wins.
Yeah.
Evangelical fraud. Yeah, I would probably put him in that category. The thing about Rob Bell is a little tough to nail down. I mean, the reason that I picked the ones I picked is because, you know, a lot of them are in jail or, you know, there are court records. I mean, you know, Rob Bell was a little bit too clever to actually get caught in his heresy. You know, so it's a little slippery. But yeah, I mean, his book Love Wins, I believe, is, you know, full of, at a minimum, extremely questionable, if not outright heretical stuff. Yeah.
My second question. Today, people and companies, they use social media and Facebook and QB codes and all that to legitify themselves and to announce their presence. And that's something that I think in our older generation has just kind of rejected and wants nothing to do with it. But as parents, shouldn't we be ahead of the curve when it comes to knowledge of this and how it works and using it as tools to instruct to our children? It
sure.
Seems like the kids are telling their parents how it is.
Yeah.
And so should we be all over this? And bringing our children into this technology and bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you know, through this technology? Or should we reject it and be on the backside when our kids fall off the wagon and their iPod gets, you know, lost in the toilet or something?
Right. Well, my tendency is to answer that. I mean, you know, God gave me 4 kids to raise. And I can tell you it's all I can do to raise those 4 kids, so I'm not going to tell you how you should raise your kids, at least beyond general principles. But I will say this, that I'm not in favor of the rejection of technology, as I've said repeatedly. You know, I'm not a Luddite, as the expression goes, which says all technology is bad. I do think we have to be discerning. I think in general we don't let children be children, they've already got, even if we try to keep them from a lot of this technology, they're going to have tremendous exposure to it anyway. So I can tell you that with my own kids, you know, my 12-year-old daughter wants a cell phone, for example, right now. Now, in my family, our kids are older. I've got a 12-year-old, but I've also got a 19-year-old, and the other two are even older than that. And so she looks at the older ones with cell phones and Twitter and Facebook and all that kind of thing and wants to have it. You know, and the answer is just no, and for now, you know. And she says, why? And I say, because I'm the dad, and I said no, you know. And, you know, and then we talk about it further. I mean, the good news is I have studied this stuff, and I can talk about it. And her name is Morgan. I just say, Morgan, I just think that you're not ready for this, that there are a lot of influences that you will encounter that I don't believe that you quite develop the ability to handle a lot of the influences that you're going to. Now, of course, she doesn't believe that. You know, she's ready. You know, she's 12 years old going on 40. She can do anything, handle anything, right? But I think that what comes through in that is that she understands that daddy loves her, right? That daddy's trying to protect her. And that she might wish that daddy wasn't as vigorous in his protection as he is. But I think, nonetheless, that her understanding that is is more likely to cause her to accept the limitations that I put on her. You know, it's funny, and this goes, you know, I mentioned antinomianism at one point, which is just a fancy word for rejecting the law. I think sometimes we forget that God gave us the law to protect us. The law is a blessing. And the reason, properly understood, we know that God gives us the law because he loves us. And that if we understand the law in the context of that love, accepting God's law, it becomes much, much easier, doesn't it? And so I think that that's the way we have to relate to our children. That we have to place boundaries. We have to say no. We have to say, put, you know, delay at least, and in some cases prohibit altogether, the use of certain of these technologies. But I think that our children need to understand this law, these restrictions in the context of the love that we have.
Can't do too many things wrong and have a son graduate from the Air Force Academy.
Yeah, I tell people when I grow up, I want to be like my son.
I'm going to give my brother Steve, Air Force retiree, the last question.
What are your opinions about forms of communication like Harry Potter and Chronicles of Narnia?
Well, those are two real different things, right? I mean, I can tell you that I like the Chronicles of Narnia. I think that there's a, you know, my own opinion is that there's a powerfully expressed biblical worldview in the Chronicles of Narnia, and I'm in favor of it. I like the, you know, read the books, let my kids read the books. The Harry Potter books are different. I mean, you know, the Harry Potter books are, you know, they promote values and ideas that I do not find as shall we say, is helpful. And now I will also confess to you, and some of you right here at the very end, I'm about to get out of here alive, and I'm about to say something that, you know, that might cause some of you to want, you know, to not like, to view what I did not forbid my kids to read the Harry Potter books when they were coming along. But they were, you know, by the time my older kids were, you know, 14 or 15 by the time they came out, and I felt like that there was, that they had a level of discernment. My 12-year-old, we've not let her read those books yet. And you know, so I don't know. Maybe I'm wishy-washy on Harry Potter. But I like the Chronicles of Narnia. I'm a big fan of the Lord of the Rings, the Tolkien books as well. I think a Christian worldview is expressed in those books. It's my personal opinion.
But not the Harry Potter?
Not so much there. There's no question that a Christian worldview is not being, I mean, it's not a Christian worldview. The real question then becomes, okay, well, you know, do you let your kids read it anyway? I mean, you know, yeah, it's not actively promoting a Christian worldview, but is it okay? And my answer to that is that once your Christian worldview has developed enough so that you can discern that this is not a Christian worldview, so that you just don't accept it uncritically, I would be in favor. Like, I wouldn't forbid any of you adults in this room. I don't think it'd be my place to forbid that. It's a matter of Christian liberty, in my opinion.